Hello, I'm Mark Peterson, and this is the Stronger Philanthropy Podcast. This is episode 14. This is where we love giving well. I'm pleased to be able to introduce to you today a friend of mine, Andy Crouch. We met about 10 years ago. This was right around the time of the publication of his book, Culture Making, which in my mind was one of the most influential Christian books of the previous decade. Since then, I've been following his work closely. Most recently, he's written Playing God, A Reflection on the Use and Abuse of Power, and Strong and Weak, A Reflection on How Living an Abundant Life Must Also Include Embracing Weakness and Suffering. Andy is the executive editor of Christianity Today and is on the boards of Fuller Theological Seminary and Equitas Group, a philanthropic organization which offers grants to organizations focused on trafficking. Let's dive into our conversation now. Andy Crouch, welcome to our podcast today.
Thank you. I am thrilled to be here.
Thanks. I was reflecting on our friendship and the first time that we met, and I don't know if you recall this, but I had a phone call out of the blue from you. Do you remember that?
I do not remember this.
You don't remember?
I'm very curious to see how you remember it.
Somehow you got my number.
Yes, right.
You got my number. I don't know who from. I think I can suspect who you might have got it from. But you called me out of the blue and you said, hey, I want to come up to Toronto and take you out for lunch.
Yeah.
And we had a nice lunch together, and it was the beginning of, we had never met before, so I think you had an interest in philanthropy and you just wanted to explore that a bit with
right,
me.
Right. I do remember the lunch, and
yeah,
it was, I remember thinking, I want to spend more time with this guy. So here we get another chance.
We do. So I appreciate it again. And so that was about 10 years ago,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
And since then I've been following you and, tracking with what you've been doing. Just give us a sense of who you are and, what your daily life looks like.
Yeah, I am a journalist is my trade for the last 10 years or so, a little more, 15 years. And before that, ministry was my calling, campus ministry. And I really feel like those two things are the poles of my life. Campus ministry, working with undergraduate students, being with people at kind of developmentally significant moments is still the most rewarding work I've ever done. And whenever I get a taste of it and get back to it, I love it. But I came out of that world into the world of writing, editing, producing about 15 years ago. And I think of the job of a journalist as to make complicated things clear quickly for people who could, to make complicated things clear quickly for people who could be doing something else. So we journalists sort of pay attention to the wide world and all its complexity, and we try to boil it down to a certain amount of simplicity without being simplistic. And that feels like a lot of what I'm called to do. So on a daily basis, I'm kind of doing that one way or another. Sometimes I'm helping other people do it as an editor. Sometimes I'm doing it as a writer. Sometimes I'm doing it as a speaker.
You are currently at Christianity Today. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah.
And so what does that involve?
Well, we're a online every day and then in print monthly magazine that tries to kind of tell the whole truth about how the gospel is at work in the world. And by that, I partly mean also to tell the truth about the Christian movement, when it's not at its best, as well as when it's at its best. I think, we try to just cover the reality of Christianity in the world. We're actually really proud of the fact that we invest in global coverage. It's hard to find the resources to do that. So a lot of our, counterpart magazines don't do as much of that, but we also cover a lot of what is happening in North American Christianity, come from a evangelical perspective, but trying to do justice to the whole range.
I've noticed in my lifetime, and I'm sure you've noticed in yours, the evangelicalism that I knew as a child is looking very different today.
Yeah.
That's maybe over a period of 50 years.
Right.
And maybe you could have a comment or two about the evolutions you see happening within this this family that we call evangelicalism.
Boy, it's so complex. Here in the U.S. particularly, the word has been almost entirely hijacked, I think it would not be too strong to say, by the mainstream media who want to account for certain political realities in the U.S. and certain kinds of voters. And the funny thing is they'll apply the word evangelical to a kind of voter who doesn't even necessarily attend church. and when you actually look at people who actually attend church, they're very different in their voting patterns and their political opinions from people who are identified by mainstream media and some pollsters as evangelical. So it's acquired this political meaning, at least in the United States, that it never had when a magazine like CT was founded by Billy Graham, who was this really important figure after World War II, who felt the need for something different from fundamentalism. There had been this fundamentalist modernist split in the early 20th century and within Protestantism in North America. But the fundamentalists had become very fractious. They'd become very, they'd become quite withdrawn from certain kinds of cultural engagement. They'd become quite suspicious of one another. It was not a healthy movement. And Graham and his friends came along and said, there must be a better way to have a Christian witness in the world. And they started putting together this movement that they called the neo-evangelicals. The evangelicals were really first used in the 19th century. And it was the great era of Christians being very socially involved on behalf of the gospel, founding universities, founding hospitals, things like the YMCA, the Young Men's Christian Association, and the YWCA. And Graham and his counterparts said, why couldn't we do that again? And out of that came, for a time, a very coherent movement that was held together, it was coherent in that it was held together by some very powerful personalities, kind of entrepreneurial personalities like Billy Graham. And they held together these people with somewhat different instincts. And what's happened in the last, I think, in your lifetime and mine, is that movement has started to sort of differentiate again. And now there's a lot of different things it can mean to be evangelical.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it used to be that it meant this kind of, on a Sunday you'd hear, just reliably hear what's called expository preaching. And there are some churches that have absolutely doubled down on that and are doing that. I'm going to be at a super hip church in San Francisco this coming week, where the pastor literally preaches verse by verse through the Bible, even though you'd walk in and all the sort of cultural trappings are very San Francisco, very kind of hip urban, but he's doing this old school kind of expository preaching on the one hand, but then you have a whole other set of evangelicals who are doing something very different with church and, you know, what that looks like. So it's no longer maybe just one movement, and there's a lot of confusion that attends to the word, and that makes for really interesting reporting for us.
I'm also interested in your work on the Equitas Group board. You're part of a board of a philanthropic organization, and I've admired that philanthropy group for some time. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, this has been a wonderful experience, and it actually started at a kind of classic evangelical gathering, a gathering related to the Lausanne movement, which is one of the most, well, really is the most important kind of global convener of evangelicals. And there was a meeting in Budapest a number of years ago, and I met Lance Robinson, who's part of a philanthropic family in Knoxville, Tennessee, and we just kind of started talking and became friends, and eventually invited me to join the board of one of several foundations that is our stewards of his family's, his wife's family's wealth and assets and generosity. And so Equitas Group focuses on a couple parts of the world where children are vulnerable, not least to all kinds of exploitation, but especially enslavement, which is the most profound vulnerability, really, that a child or anyone can experience, and also sexual abuse. And so we focus on Haiti and Southeast Asia, and have had kind of program investments in those two specific places, mostly Cambodia and Southeast Asia, as well as trying to encourage holistic thinking about justice in the church, wherever it is, including in North America. So it's been such a great experience just to come alongside Lance, his family, and the other board members and staff members, and try to be good stewards of what we have to give, and try to do philanthropy well in places of great vulnerability, which is challenging and rewarding, and you learn an awful lot as you go. It's been amazing.
That's great. It's a model I don't often see, that a philanthropic family invite a third party, an outside person, not family, to be on the board. And I really admire them for doing that. I think, can you think a little bit about how your presence on that board has changed the dynamic in some way?
Well, I'm not, yes, and I'm not the only person outside the family. In fact, the majority of the board of Equitas Group is not related to the family. And how has that made a difference? I hope what we've been able to do is bring, let me put it this way. All healthy generosity begins with passion and begins with a sense of the heart and a kind of a love that goes beyond, you know, just kind of wanting good for people, to like an active sense of yearning to see other people flourish. Mm-hmm. And I think that Lance and his family have experienced that in places like Haiti and Southeast Asia. And the reason we're in those two places really is because of profound kind of heart engaging experiences that they had in those places. But to be really effective and strategic and in the long run, that heart passion has to get tempered and channeled into a kind of attentive and careful way of acting. Because, you know, even when we think about how romantic love works, I mean, it begins usually often with this kind of almost uncontrollable passion or sense of attraction or connection. But ultimately that has to be channeled into, ideally, between a man and a woman in marriage. And then marriage is meant to take all of that and put it, there's certain kinds of routines, there's certain kinds of commitments, there's a longer horizon than whatever the passion initially was. And you set up all these practices and disciplines and commitments and promises that enable you to really fulfill what that initial longing was about. So I have seen my job as a member of the board as being someone who helps channel that passion just through asking really good questions about what would be the most strategic way to invest in this particular issue. In Haiti, we've worked on this issue called Restivec, which is a Creole word that essentially translates into kind of domestic servitude. But it's very close to slavery in many cases. And, you know, you can get very passionate about that, but what's the right intervention for that? And at what point in the cycle of vulnerability that really begins with a family, often in a rural area that has more children than they can provide for, do you intervene in that rural area? Do you intervene when the child arrives in the city? Do you intervene with the child? Do you intervene with the family that may be employing or exploiting them? Like, these are the kind of questions you have to work your way through, and you have to have some kind of theory of change that you then test. And being from outside and coming in a few times a year intensively to sort of pay attention, read reports, listen, respond, ask questions, hopefully has helped all of us to get a clearer sense of what is it we're aiming for here and how do we know when we're making a difference. So I hope I've been able to be part of that.
Your most recent book is Strong and Weak, and you really spoke to me through that book as I read it. It's a short book. I reflect a lot about strength and weakness because of my role as a philanthropist. And I think that people who have money, the tendency is you're coming from a place of great strength, great power. You mm-hmm. have money, you have ideas, you have connections. And it somehow puts you in a very rarefied place in the stratosphere, you know. And I wondered if you could...
People call you up and ask to have...
That's right. That's right. Who does that? And yet I think there's great temptations for people of wealth, people who have money and who are investing it in philanthropic activity. What would you say are the greatest temptations for these people, such as me and others? And how do we mitigate this tendency?
Yeah, the book Strong and Weak is about, it's really about just one idea, as you know, and that is that healthy human lives, healthy human communities, families, organizations, really any human presence in the world is healthy and flourishing to the extent that we combine authority and vulnerability. And strong and weak is just another way of saying that, strength and weakness. In the book, I mostly use the words authority and vulnerability. And this is rooted for me in what it is to be human. That in fact, the striking and fascinating thing about human beings is that we have more authority than any other creature. And I think when we look biblically as Christians at this, we see that God has given human beings this kind of extraordinary role of representing the Creator in the midst of the creation, has given us dominion, is the language of Genesis, over the world. So great authority. And at the same time, we have more vulnerability than any other creature. Other creatures are limited in the sort of exposure to risk, which is what I think vulnerability is about. Every creature is mortal, but only human beings, it seems, are fully kind of conscious that we're mortal. We live our lives in the horizon of our mortality. So part of our vulnerability is our awareness, our consciousness that we have to a greater degree, it seems, than any other creature. We're more dependent than any other creature. We depend on one another for care at the beginning and end of life much longer than any other animal. Even our, you know, close analogs in the primates don't have as long an infancy and don't have as long a period of old age. And there's many other ways you can talk about. We're also so relational, like we're designed in this intense way. I mean, it relates to what we're talking about that sense of love and passion. And that's not just expressed in romance and eros, but in all kinds of need for connection. But any connection like that makes you vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And other creatures don't bond in that way. I mean, some other creatures pair bond for life, but it's not the same, it seems. So I think that these two things together actually bear the image of God, and that actually what it is to be an image bearer of God is to both have authority and vulnerability, both capacity for meaningful action, that's another way of thinking of authority, and exposure to meaningful risk. And when you actually think about the moments in your life when you have experience the greatest sense of flourishing, of being fully yourself, I can almost guarantee that if we had time to talk about whatever those moments were, there was authority there and there was vulnerability there on your own part, and probably someone else also was exercising authority in your life and was exercising vulnerability. So that's the key idea of the book. And then the sort of subsequent idea is that the tragedy of the human story is that we don't live there, that instead many people live with a lot of vulnerability and no authority. And I think that's poverty. But then others, and this gets to your question about those of us who have wealth of various kinds, and I think you rightly sort of alluded to the fact it's not actually just financial wealth, it's other kinds of social, what we call social capital, that there's another distortion, which is to have authority without vulnerability. And this comes when you have a lot of capacity to act, but that acting doesn't expose you to risk. And I actually think that that's the greatest danger in human life, is to have authority without vulnerability. And there's two versions of it. One is a kind of active version and one is a kind of invisible version. So the active version is when I actually seek to have this experience of lots of authority, but to insulate myself from risk. You know, to leave the topic of philanthropy for a moment, the clearest examples of this, I think, often are addictions. where we look for an experience that will give us this elevated sense of, wow, I'm really living, I'm really alive here. But our addictions always come with this kind of implicit promise that we won't be vulnerable. We often use them to insulate ourselves from our sense of pain or exposure. And I think the human story is about us and our parents, all the way back to our first parents, saying, hearing two promises, you shall be like God and you shall not surely die, which are the two promises made in the garden on behalf of the fruit. And that's a promise of authority. You shall be like God without vulnerability. You shall not surely die. So one temptation is to use all of this kind of capital that we have in its various forms to give us a tremendous sense of capacity to act, because every human being wants that. And you can quickly get that with money. In fact, money is unique in how liquid it is. Other forms of power are, they're hard to measure, they're hard to store, and they're hard to exchange. But money can be measured, stored, and exchanged. It's the most storable, countable, and fungible form of power, to use kind of technical language. Mm-hmm. And this makes it very tempting to use wealth, whether in consumption and spending or philanthropy and giving, as a way to give myself an elevated sense that I'm making a difference in the world.
Yeah.
The problem is that wealth comes with such power that other people will not require you to be vulnerable while you do that. They will put up with a great deal of invulnerability. And one of the things I've noticed that happens to powerful people, and you and I are both in this category potentially, but of course we always think of people more powerful than us, but actually this is probably anyone listening to this podcast, to some extent this is true, is that they put in place in their lives systems, sometimes systems they can see, sometimes systems they can't see, that allow them to act without taking a lot of risk. And I had this happen with a very powerful person who I was hosting in a meeting a few months ago. I'll sort of disguise the details of this because it's not my purpose to call this individual out, but this is a powerful person. And those of us who were hosting him made all these arrangements for his lodging and meals and so forth at this meeting that we were having. And meanwhile, he made completely other arrangements without ever, you know, sort of bothering to mention to us what he was doing. And we then, when we found out what his plans were, we just sort of invisibly scrambled to accommodate his plans. So he never really found out how much sort of scurrying his presence had caused. And that, I think, leads actually to the second category I would have for this, which is what you might call privilege, which is basically invisible protection from risk. And we move through the world, those of us who are residents of places like the US and Canada, those of us especially who have certain amounts of means, we move through a world that is constantly scurrying ahead of us and around us to give us this sensation of authority and to minimize our sense of vulnerability. And nowhere does that happen more than in the philanthropic setting, because you are often dealing with people who have very urgent needs for provision for the work that they feel called to do. And there you are with those resources, and no one in the position of someone requesting a grant is likely to confront you with your vulnerability or ask you to take an uncomfortable risk. They're going to do everything they can to make you comfortable.
Right.
I remember a young woman I knew, a graduate of Harvard, was sort of doing some career searching. She was trying to figure out what she wanted to do after college. And she did an interview with someone who worked, I think, at the Pew Charitable Trust here in Philadelphia, where I live. He was a program officer. And she was thinking, well, that might be a worthwhile work. And his advice to her, he said, you should not do this job for at least 10 years, because once you take this job, no one will ever tell you you're wrong.
Yeah, that's right.
And all your jokes will be funny. All your comments will be insightful. He said it's the worst thing for a 22-year-old to be in this role, because you get a very inaccurate sense of yourself. And I think that's the danger, is that we just have this powerful set of forces that are actually, even without us trying or asking for it, are insulating us from finding out the truth about the world, the truth about ourselves, and insulating us from the real healthy risk that would lead to flourishing for everybody.
Mm, very good. Can you help us think through some of the risks that a philanthropist could start to take in order to become more vulnerable.
Yeah. And I think we have to be honest and say that, you know, especially to the, when we cross tremendous gulfs of affluence or political power. So for example, when the program officers and directors of the Equitas Group go to Haiti, we have to honestly say we will never completely be vulnerable in the way that the people we're among are. I mean, they walk out their doors every day. I mean, just the fact that I can travel to Haiti, but someone from Haiti cannot travel to the United States without going through all kinds of challenges to get visas and so forth. And I literally do not have to think about it. I can get on the plane and I can get on the plane coming back. And there's these asymmetries that we'll never get rid of. Right. It would be very foolish to pretend we will. At the same time, I think, you know, the goal is to take meaningful risks. So the goal is not just to take willy-nilly risks. So I wear a seatbelt whenever I can when I'm in Haiti, even though I know most Haitians don't wear seatbelts, because I don't think it's a very meaningful risk, should I be in an accident, to not be, you know, have whatever protection I can. On the other hand, if I, as I have seen some people do, if I go to a place of great material need and I spend the whole time in an air-conditioned SUV with tinted windows that allows me to see other people, but they can't see me, and I basically drive in my air-conditioned bubble from meeting to meeting in the rare air-conditioned rooms in places like Port-au-Prince, I'm missing out on a tremendous opportunity to, in a meaningful way, get out of that bubble of Western affluence and just walk on the street with some friends, walk into a home, share something of the story of my family, hear something face-to-face of someone else's family. Rather, so, you know, one very simple thing I think is just don't just do business. If you come just to do business, people will do that because they need, your support. But there's a way of signaling, I want to know who you are and I want you to know who I am and who I really am. And I remember the last trip we took with Equitas, one of our fellow board members, Kent Annan, spent a number of years living in Haiti. He's American, actually Canadian and American. And he took us to the Lacou, which is the kind of family compound of a family that he had lived with for a couple of years, and we stayed there overnight. And I will say the rest of the trip, we were in, you know, decent kind of more Western style lodgings or American style lodgings. But that night we were in a very small, very hot little house with where the electricity turned off at midnight.
Yeah.
And with, you know, no running water, no, the latrine was sort of in a general direction from the home.
Yeah.
It was the best thing we did, yes, to be with that family, to let them serve us. I think being the recipient of hospitality is actually a vulnerable thing.
Learning to receive. Yeah.
Receiving it and not really being able to compensate them. At least, I mean, I think that we helped with the cost of the meal probably, but in the deeper sense, like, we were so warmly welcomed in ways that honestly I wouldn't know how to do if you came to my house, to be totally candid, because people in the rest of the world know things about hospitality that we in the West have totally forgotten.
Yes.
For me personally, one of the hardest things is being hot at night. I love my sleep and I have a really hard time with heat. And man, that night, and I know you've had experiences like this, you've probably done this much more than I have, but that night from 12 when the lights went out until 6 a.m. in Haiti, because of certain traditional kind of ways of life, they close up the houses at night. Mm. So that it's just starting to cool off outside.
Oh.
It's like 95 degrees at least inside the home.
And you're trapped.
30 degrees Celsius. And I'm in this little bed with three of my friends all around me. I can't move. I am so hot. I can't possibly sleep. And it's so still and just close, you know. And I thought, this is exactly where I need to be. And I said, God, I do not know how to get through this the next 6 hours. I don't think I'm going to sleep very much, but I'm just going to lie here and pray. It was one of the best things I've done.
Mm. It reprioritizes our lives, doesn't it? These experiences.
Oh, my gosh.
Just getting rid of some of the things that we esteem as being so important in our lives.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that actually they're important to us because they mostly insulate us from risk.
Yes.
And they also give us this elevated sense of authority. I can get up and do something. I could look at my phone. There are all these things I can do to give myself a kind of simulation of action. Mm. Even if I wake up in the middle of the night in my own home, I have things I can do. I had none of that there. And that's actually exactly where I needed to be. Mm. Compared to my hosts, I was still way over on the authority without vulnerability side of human experience. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, I think if you embed that enough in your relationships with people, something changes.
Thanks, Andy, for joining us today and giving us so much to consider. I hope today's interview encourages greater willingness to risk and engage, that we as philanthropists can be challenged by those situations and people that we want to help, and we can actually be transformed by engaging with them. You can find more about Andy by visiting his website, which I will include in the show notes. Links to each of his books are located there, and if you haven't read them yet, I encourage you to purchase them. I've also written a book review on Strong and Weak, and I've posted it on my blog. The link to that is in the show notes as well. That concludes today's podcast. You can subscribe to this podcast at our website at strongerphilanthropy.ca. Or you can find us on iTunes or your Android podcatcher apps. If you want to reach out, feel free to connect by email at strongerphilanthropy@gmail.com. Message me on Twitter @LoveGivingWell or on Facebook @StrongerPhilanthropy. Buen camino.